For the final week of Bush Telegraph, we're looking at how some of the major issues that we've covered over the life of the program have changed during the last 15 years. Today it's climate with Professor Tim Flannery, Chief Counsellor with the Australian Climate Council, a man who, of course, has been one of the most vocal public voices in this debate around Australia and internationally on climate change. Tim Flannery, thank you so much for coming in. Appreciate it.
It's a great pleasure.
And we'll say up front, you've got the family here with you today?
I do. I've got little Bubs, little Colby in here. He's 17 months old. So I think about his life, and the last 15 years look short compared with concerns for the future.
So 17 months old, I guess it changes how you think about the future and the climate that the little ones might be living in.
Oh, I remember when he was born thinking, you know, this little boy is likely to be alive in 2100.
Mm.
And you think about those distant climate projections, they become very real very quickly.
When you've got one that'll that'll be there to see it.
That's right.
Can we go back 15 years when Bush Telegraph was starting?
Sure.
What was the debate like then about climate change?
Well, back in 1999, the IPCC had produced two reports, but they were rather kind of weak and didn't get much publicity. So that was before the big report in 2001, I think it was, that came out. There was almost no public understanding of the issue. I remember the clean energy options open to people who wanted to do something were very, very limited. It was really only the eccentrics who were doing it.
Yeah. There's people off the grid, sort of meant off the grid in a mental sense as well.
Exactly.
I remember
even as late as 2007, you know, there was only 7,000 grid-connected solar, PV panels on households in Australia. There's now 1.4 million.
Mm.
So, you know, it's incredibly There wasn't any wind turbines in South Australia in 2003. Now you look at the number, you know, $5.5 billion of investment, half of it into regional Australia, drought-proofing farms, you know, giving income in the regions there and creating a major export industry for electricity generation for that state. So lots changed.
So it's easy to think that there's been no progress, I guess, when you read the papers day to day. But an example like the wind farms, the fact that South Australia's gone from none to an awful lot, I don't know what the figures are, there's progress right there.
On some days, wind provides 100% of the state's electricity requirements.
Mm.
So, things have changed, you know, but you've got to balance that against the thought that we're burning more coal than ever, you know. So energy demand's gone up. Sure, the renewables have grown, but they're not where they need to be to tip the balance yet.
But if we go back to 1999, internationally, the Kyoto Protocol was being discussed, been discussions for a couple of years?
It was, but the Kyoto Protocol at that stage was really a discussion about the developed countries and how much effort they would put in.
Mm.
And the developing countries like China were let go their own way. So China was just building coal-fired power plants. They were building two a week for a while there. And that wasn't being reined in. So it's only now that we're starting to look at the world as a whole and say, what are we going to do about this problem at a global level rather than just a developed country level?
But what sort of warnings were there for rural Australia, people that live by the coast, people that are exposed to droughts, feel the hardships of droughts? Were the warnings from scientists there in 1999?
Well, I guess, you know, the people who have the privilege of living in the Australian bush, they've got this bittersweet experience of living in one of the most beautiful places on earth, but also one of the harshest and most variable places on earth. So if you go back to 1998 and the massive El Nino year we had that year and the dry conditions over parts of the country and the heat, that was an exceptional year.
Mm.
And they'd experienced that. The warnings, I guess, were there, but at that stage we hadn't seen The climate hadn't changed enough to really start impacting on the extremes like it is today. So it was the way I think of it back then was climate change was theoretical for a lot of people. You had to sort of understand the science to be concerned, whereas it's a lived experience for a lot of people now, you know, from people in New York who've experienced Hurricane Sandy through to the Queenslanders who went through the unprecedented floods in 2010, through to the Victorians who survived or didn't survive the, you know, 2009 bushfires down here. It's lived experience now for a lot of people.
It tends to be a question after any extreme weather event now is this linked to climate change.
That's right, it is. And of course, you know, what we say is climate change is a strong influence on these extreme events. Doesn't explain it entirely because the climate system's complicated and, you know, there's many factors that come to bring to bear on, say, a bushfire, really extreme bushfire or a drought or a flood or whatever.
Mm.
But climate change is increasingly a strong influence.
So you gave us some examples of the, I guess, people's interest in renewable energies that have changed over the 15 years. But have you witnessed any major change in the Australian landscape or the coastal regions?
I think that, look, there has been changes, and if I could just run through a few. I was up in Torres Strait fairly recently, and the degree of coastal flooding up there is quite evident now. Sea levels there are rising at the rate of about 9 millimetres a year, so that's nearly a centimetre a year. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the Torres Strait Islands are quite low-lying, so that changing, shifting the baseline there is having an impact. I suppose, I remember being down in Tassie years ago now, and going up to the central plateau there and seeing all these dead eucalypt trees as far as you could see, and asking a National Parks ranger about what it was. And the lady said, look, it's nothing to worry about, really. It's just that the summers are getting a bit warmer and we're getting a little bit less rain. And I kind of thought, well, that's everything to worry about.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
But so, the changes like that, and people out in the bush will notice them probably more than most. I was talking to a veterinarian at Broken Hill recently. He was saying, live weights now and live births for sheep and cattle in the area are declining because as these heat waves are getting more intense, it interferes with the ability of the pregnant animal to form the placenta, form a competent placenta. So live birth weights are down, and that's a direct impact of these heat waves. Of course, some of my mates in Western Victoria that were getting around all winter in gumboots in the 70s, they're growing crops now, growing bloody acres of canola. And that's a big change for the Western District. So
I find the observations that people who live on the land or live with the natural resources to be really interesting. You get the wine grape growers that have their records that say the harvest is shifting, or the people in the fishing industry. Tassie's another good example that say they're catching things now or seeing pests that they didn't see before.
Well, that's right. I remember over in Western Australia a year ago opening the West Australian, which isn't the most climate kind of conscious newspaper in Australia, but there the front page was all about these tropical fish all being caught off Perth for the first time in large numbers. And that's what climate change is about, is those big shifts.
Yeah, so we are seeing, even on a very local level, in the last 15 years, you've seen some of these changes.
Oh, yeah, and we'll see them increasingly. Some people still fail to see them because they don't kind of understand fully what to look for, I suppose. I remember talking to some farmers who had records, this is from Western New South Wales, going back a century. And they said, look, nothing much has changed because there was dust storms in great-grandma's time. They're in her diary, and there was droughts and there was floods. And all of that's really true. Mm. But it's the nature of the events that's now shifting. So you've got to look a little bit deeper than just, it's a land of drought and flooding rain to see the impacts.
Yeah, just a little bit of input from Colby there.
That's right. He's been pretty good, though.
Yeah, he's fantastic. I think it's interesting, though, the response you hear from rural Australia, and I'm sure you know as well as I do that there's mixed views amongst farmers as to how much change in the climate is due to human activity and how much is variability versus climate change. How much sympathy do you have for that view from farmers that say, look, we've got records that do show this has all happened before, and here I am being forced to pay more to run my irrigator in the past under the carbon tax situation for something that I have seen happen before? It almost feels like I'm being told to pay for the concerns of the inner city lot.
Sure. Look, no one likes increases in taxes or payment or whatever else. If you can separate that out for a minute and just say, let's put aside the issue of who should pay for what, but just look at those records people talk about. They say, in times past there was droughts and floods. I mean, I'm really sympathetic with those views, but I do try to urge those people to look a little bit more into the issue and to say, well, if you've had floods like in Queensland, 2010, those floods were unprecedented. Why were they so widespread? 80% of the state underwater. Why did that happen? Because the sea surface temperatures off the coast were hotter than they've ever been in the history of record keeping, and hot water evaporates more easily, and you get the right wind conditions and right weather conditions, you get big rainfall events, which is what we saw in 2010. So, and that extra hot oceans is coming from the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. We've got to know that scientifically. So, and then, 3 years later, there's Queensland, 80% of the place drought declared. Now, it's always been a land of drought and flooding rains, but when do you get record-breaking floods followed by record-breaking droughts? It's that acceleration. It's that, increase that's the signature of climate change.
So when you say look a little deeper, is that an encouragement for people to look at longer records beyond the weather or climate records on their own property?
I think so. And talk to people about the changes. I remember talking to some old shearers in Western Victoria or Western New South Wales, actually, and that we were talking about climate change. I said, well, have you noticed any change in your life? And one old bloke said, yeah, mate, it's been quite a while now since I've had to knock the ice off my shaving mug in the morning. He said, sometimes I've got 3/4 of an inch of ice on it, I had to break through before I could have a shave, before I went out shearing. It doesn't happen anymore. And that's really one of the big signatures of climate change. And, the nights stay warmer. than they did in the past, because there's a blanket of greenhouse gases keeping the heat in. So if I was a farmer out in Western New South Wales or anywhere in Australia trying to understand this, I'd talk to my neighbours a bit and say, what changes are you seeing? You know, what are you, what's happening in your world? Talk to the local vet. Talk to, you know, people who are growing other crops and, or as you say, grape growers, whoever. And you'll see that there's a lot of impact. Some of them are subtle because we're only at the beginning of a process, but, you know, they're quite revealing.
But is there a bit of a contradiction there to say talk to your neighbour and hear about when they used to have to knock the ice off their shaver, but don't look at your own records that might go back 100 years or more?
Well, I'm not saying don't look at your own records. Those records are absolutely invaluable, but it's interpreting them that's the issue. And, you know, it usually a lot of those farm diaries might say we've had a terrible drought, but they may not give you the precise figures. Some might give you rainfall or whatever, but you've then got to compare that with comparable figures, you know, from the modern day. So it's often that's quite a complicated process. So I think they're very valuable inputs, but they're not the whole story, which is why I'm encouraging people just to get out and look a bit more widely than their own records.
You're hearing here from Professor Tim Flannery, Chief Counsellor with the Australian Climate Council. And for the last week of Bush Telegraph, we're looking at some of the big issues that we've covered throughout the life of the program and how they've evolved over the last 15 years. And today, of course, is climate change. What needs to happen from here? Where do we go?
Well, I think that for the rural sector, what we need to do is offer opportunity. And if you look at the opportunities that exist now in the clean energy sector, they're quite good, particularly for the regions. And I say that because if you take a country town, Colby's he is a fan of clean energy, but he's just not too engaged at the moment.
You're used to people interrupting, though, aren't you?
That's right, I am, indeed. But look, you know, take a country town and think about filling your car with petrol or putting on your electricity or whatever you do, you know. And a lot of people now in the regions are realising, well, that's money. Whenever I do that, that's money going out of the community. It's going to head office in Sydney or even, you know, overseas. And a lot of people say, well, why don't we start generating energy in our own communities, make a business of this? So a town like Bathurst, for example, you know, $50 million a year gets lost in energy costs out of that community. If you had a community-owned wind farm, you had some sort of a photovoltaic cooperative, or you had a biofuels business, that's money that would be staying in your community. So I think rather than look at the downside of the tax that you might pay on electricity use, look at the business opportunities that now exist. And wind is such a classy example of that. I mean, in South Australia, which has had very good wind policy, we've had $5.5 billion of foreign investment in that state, half of it in regional South Australia. And that has really revitalised a lot of communities in the regions. And that's they make money out of that year in, year out. It's not just a one-off thing.
But then there's the community in Victoria near Dalesford that have done the same thing, invested in a wind turbine there, and yet they've taken the risk and they, I guess, they bear the costs of policy uncertainty now as well. It hasn't all been smooth sailing for them.
That's right. There is risk involved. And, you know, you've got to realise that these state governments often either own or make a lot of money from the current electricity setup. So they're running their coal mines and their coal-fired power plants and they don't want to lose that income. So the community, the people who votes them in, get to be the enemies in a way when they try to actually generate their own electricity. So I think that, sure, it's not an easy road, but ultimately we know that power has to go to the people, that once people control electricity generation and whatever else, regionally as we see in Germany, you get a much better outcome. So,
but what about beyond the big policy questions and things like energy generation, you know, these big projects and big questions, what about at the really individual level? What will farming, agriculture, particularly on the margins, look like in Australia in the decades ahead?
Wow, well, that's such a good question. And it's one that, because there you're dealing with the interface between the climate and all of the things that grow, it's a very complex equation and it's very hard to work out. But the way that I think people on the land look at it, as well as scientists, is that if you can create more robust ecosystems and systems on farm, then you're likely to get a better outcome almost regardless of what happens. So those farmers that are trying to keep water on their property longer rather than have it all run off, you know, that's just such a great asset, a good thing to be doing. farmers that are doing rotational grazing or zero kill, zero till, you know, farm management. You go out to those places, they just look so healthy and good, and the soil is better, you know.
So this is that, there's that group or movement that call themselves regenerative farmers now instead of sustainable farmers. Is that what you're talking about?
Exactly. Yeah. And look, they're the experts in it. I'm kind of a keen observer from the sidelines, but a lot of those people out there are absolutely the world experts in their area. They know their farm, they know the systems, and they do fantastic things.
But do you look at Australia in the years ahead and think maybe some of those areas, the rangelands areas, some of the very marginal cropping areas may no longer be there in a productive sense in the years ahead?
When I think about that country, I guess in my imagination I go back, you know, through 50,000 years of Aboriginal habitation of that country, and people have always been there. Sure, in the extreme dry ice ages, parts of the country might have been depopulated, but it's an extraordinary, when you think about that 50,000 year history and the enormous privilege that the farmers who are there now carry to be really the people who live that environment. I think that's just such a powerful thing that, you know, I don't like talking about people moving off the land. I think that people will always maintain some connection. And maybe the farms will be bigger. Who knows what this is? Or maybe people will diversify. Mm. You know,
but it's a real question, though, isn't it? How will people stay on the land in a productive sense?
Well, let's follow that up a bit, you know, and think, okay, go back to 1999, the beginning of bush tally, right? You've got a lot of farmers in Western or the parts of South Australia, Eyre Peninsula and so forth, who are facing a drying climate. If you would have asked a climate scientist back then, they would have said, gee, things are looking really bad for Southern Australia, rainfall's going to decline, maybe we'll have to walk away from that land. Today, 15 years on, people have found a massive new resource, which is delivering tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars a year to properties, which is the wind. Who would have believed that what would have been looked at as a liability 15 years ago is now a major new industry for that area? So I just don't think we're going to predict the future that way. Yeah. And we need to think deeply about this and realise we live in a really changing world, honour the past and that deep, deep history, and contextualise ourselves and our interactions with the land in that context, and be optimistic. I just think we have to. I mean, it's...
So what, that desire to live in the landscape, the outback in Australia's case for many people, or a small proportion of people, but still a lot of Australians, what that will overcome the challenges, they'll find a way.
Oh, you live with the sun coming up and then the sun slowly going down and the patterns of the winds and the stars and the phases of the moon. You live with all of that and the seasons, you know, or the lack of seasons in part of the country. And having all of that wash over you does contextualise you, and I don't think you can afford to take it lightly or ever fail to see the privilege of it.
Mm. Do you feel sometimes we, as a nation, get caught up in the political debate or look to politicians to offer solutions or the way forward here, when essentially it can come down to the individual at the very local level? Clearly that's not going to address the big picture, but the local level.
Politicians are continuously trying to tribalise us and say, look, there's the enemy. Let's marshal and unite so we can defeat the enemy. That's a load of rubbish. I mean, we're all Australians at the end of the day. We're all, you know... Most of us, if not all of us, are looking out for the good of the country. We have common sense and respect for the country and the environment, and we've got to find a way forward together. Mm. So the political process, to me, is the enemy. We need a different way of doing it. And, do you know, I one of my great people I admire most was an old ancient Roman called Cincinnatus, you know, and he, for 500 BC, Rome was under attack. He was called in because there was no one else who knew how to defend. No one was brilliant to defend the country. He was a farmer, lived on a little humble family farm outside Rome. Came in, they said, look, if you can beat the enemy, we'll make you dictator for 6 months. He came in, defeated the enemy. 15 days later, he was back on his farm. Mm. So he was a citizen politician, right? He didn't want to be part of the big thing. We need more people like that. We need more people who step up out of their daily life into politics and be true leaders rather than these divisive kind of people, these scaremongers that we have at the moment who try to divide us and create this sort of tribal world that ends up going nowhere in the end.
You're hearing here from Professor Tim Flannery on Bush Telegraph. We're talking about the big issue of climate change. You talk about division and divisive people. Some people would see you as a divisive figure in this debate. Now, these days, I imagine you probably didn't see that coming 15 years back.
No, I didn't, and I certainly try not to be divisive. People will use what they perceive me to be and try to, again, make me the enemy for people to rally against. But I just, you know, I don't think that's right. You can't do that. And people put words in my mouth and say I've said this, why, this and that and the other to try to score some political points. But I'm really careful not to side with one side of politics or the other.
But do you think you can, as an individual, can you be a unifying force around this issue in the future, or is that opportunity maybe passed?
Well, what I try to do with the Climate Council now is just give people the facts that they need to make up their own mind, you know, and let them know what's happening, because it's such a contested space. There's a lot of misinformation out there on the internet and whatever, and people need somewhere they can go where we can actually trust the information, which is one of the reasons we don't comment on policy, you know, at the Climate Council, because the minute you do that, you politicise yourself. So, you know, it's better to give away the power to comment on policy and retain or build the authority to be a trusted source of information, at least in our view.
Yeah, but you as an individual have been attacked more based on the predictions or the statements you've made around science in the past rather than any political comments?
Supposedly said, you know. Yeah. But again, it all only happens in political cycles. You know, while I was climate commissioner, I was attacked relentlessly. Now that I'm not, I've sort of been forgotten as an enemy by those who were trying to attack me. So it's political opportunism that drives a lot of that.
You got a thicker skin than you once had, though?
Oh, yeah. I don't give a stuff about any of that stuff, really. I mean, I think that in the end, the common sense of the people will prevail.
Mm. Before I let you go, you've seen so much of the country. What's most special, or some of the most special places and parts of Australia for you?
I remember being in and South Australia in the Lake Frome Basin in the 1970s after those big rains that we had, you know, and we're driving in a couple of old Land Rovers out to a place called Lake Pimper to the west of Lake Eyre, and going over sand dunes and through the interdune valleys, and the place was like a Garden of Eden. I think it was a yellow flower, a purple one in the swales, and on the dunes was all these white daisies, and it went for mile after mile after mile. The old mulga trees, the water hadn't got down to their roots yet, so they still looked like sort of skeletal figures up on the, you know, where they grew. Mm. But there was this, it was a Garden of Eden of flowers, and there was frogs there coming out of the sand dunes. And I remember getting up one night, and it was a clear, crystal clear night with the big moon up, and I sat on top of a sand dune and just watched the moon for an hour or two and looked around and realised that all of the white daisies were facing the moon. They'd all moved around to face the moon, so they're photosensitive. So I don't know what it's all about. I guess it's to attract night flying moths or something, but the entire landscape was facing this celestial globe. It was one of those magical moments where you say, this country is, it's older, deeper, wiser, more incredible than I could ever have imagined.
Yeah. Having only seen that part of the world around the Lake Eyre region in dry, I find it so hard to picture that, what you're describing there.
Yeah, I've never seen it before, never seen it since, and I probably will never see it again.
Yeah. I'm going to sound like the pessimist here while you sound like the optimist, but I also have a memory of standing on a sand dune, that part of Australia, and seeing weeds and just thinking, is there anywhere that's untouched now?
There's nowhere that's untouched. We're in the middle of a great transformative process where planet Earth is becoming kind of a human habitat in a way. But some places do lumber on. They've got so much inertia behind them after billions of years of evolution that they kind of will lumber on, and there'll be weeds and there'll be rabbits and everything else, but they'll lumber on.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's the message then? Optimism for the future, huh?
Yeah, it is. Optimism, looking for opportunity, trying to create opportunity for young people, never giving up. You know, if you think you're having a hard time out in the bush now, think about those thousands of generations who've done it tough through the Ice Age and through everything else before. And just, I think, just be deeply comforted by the privilege of being one of the few who is enjoying that incredible land.
Well, it's from my point of view, it's been a privilege to sit in the Bush Telegraph chair for the last few years and get to have discussions like this. Thanks so much for coming in and being part of our last week. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
That's Professor Tim Flannery, Chief Counsellor with the Australian Climate Council.